welcome to Medium Cool, a movie podcast. I'm your host, Austin Glidden, and as always, you can find us on social media by searching Medium Cool Pod on Instagram, or you can email us at mediumcoolpod@gmail.com. I am here today to talk about several things, but the first thing I want to address here is about a month ago or over the last month, 6 weeks, something like that. I had posted some movie screen cap challenges on our Instagram page just to see if anyone would be interested in trying to complete these, you know, and like see if they could guess what they are. And we had two guesses for two of the four or five. I can't remember how many. I think I did five, but but there were a couple. One is a friend of the show who's never been on the show, but I've talked about him a lot. Brandon Thrasher, he got Beyond the Black Rainbow. So I'm pretty sure we actually watched that movie together. So that's really kind of cheating. But no, he got it legit, though. He got it legit. If we watched it, it was over 10 years ago. So that's legit. And then Nicholas Arthur Arbogast got The Long Goodbye. So thanks, Nick, for giving us a comment. Also, go check out Nick's band, Shipwreck Carpathos. They're really amazing. They just put on a new record this year. Actually, maybe even a month ago or something. Either way, it's great. Go check it out. You can get it on Spotify and different things. So as you can hear, several of my friends got involved in this, but I would love to see more people involved. So if you're interested in doing any of the screen cap challenges, see what's up there right now. See if you can get any of those. If I see some interaction, maybe I'll keep doing it. It's a fun thing to do. I have a bunch of them ready. It's just I haven't programmed any more to go out. So if you're into the movie screen cap challenge idea, I will announce you on the show. So that's just a little fun thing that you can get involved with on our Instagram page. We'll see if I ever move over to TikTok at some point. That's just extra time. As you very well know, I barely have time to do this. You know what I'm saying? And it's like I want to go to TikTok and do some like movie reviews and talk about like recommendations and stuff. It would be super fun. I used to do a lot of videography and different things, so it'd be fun to just like exercise some of those muscles. But quite frankly, I just don't have time right now. So hopefully that will be a thing in the future. Now, today's episode is going to be focused on one film in particular. I'm pretty sure last week I mentioned that we were going to talk about Being John Malkovich and The Abyss for the movie review series that we're doing here on Medium Cool. And I had Joe and Sam on, and we talked about Being John Malkovich for a solid 45 give or take minutes, and then we talked about The Abyss for like over an hour. So I decided to make these two separate, but I'm so excited to talk about The Abyss on the show that I'm actually going to do the one we talked about first on the show, basically. So we actually discussed these in one conversation, and we did Being John Malkovich first, and that's in the can. I'm going to post that in the coming weeks. When I don't have other guests that I'm working in, I will post that. So if you, by chance, watched Being John Malkovich, you're still good. We are definitely going to talk about that. But we're going to talk about The Abyss today. And I'm very, very excited to talk about that. But I'm also going to do a solo review first on, on Dune Part 2. Now, I saw this like the weekend it came out or something. I mean, it's like a long time ago, but I was working on the schedule for the show, and we weren't posting episodes at the time, so I just didn't get a chance to talk about it. But I want to talk about it today, because, well, I'm not going to tell you why. You'll learn when we get to that segment. So, again, keep an eye out for the Being John Malkovich episode. We are going to talk about The Abyss. I have a lot of really awesome guests coming up, by the way, like new-to-the-show guests that I'm currently working on getting solidified in the schedule. Some of them are returning, though, but they haven't been on here in 3 years or something. I mean, it's been a while. So, it'd be really fun to bring some folks back. Some of them are musicians, so it'd be fun to talk about like music and movies. Obviously, we're going to be drawing it back to those movies. But I think it's going to be a lot of fun. So all that said, at the end of the show, keep listening. After our conversation about The Abyss, I'm going to talk about what's coming out this week and, doing some outro things. So that will be coming up. But first, here's my review of Dune Part 2. Dune Part 2. directed by Denis Villeneuve, written by Villeneuve and John Spates. Of course, the original book was written by Frank Herbert. The cast: Timothée Chalamet, Zendaya, Rebecca Ferguson, Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin, Austin Butler, Florence Pugh, Dave Bautista, Christopher Walken, Lea Seydoux, Stellan Skarsgård, who's so good, by the way, and Charlotte Rampling, to, I would say, probably just name but a few. I don't know. There's just a lot of people in this. Who can keep track? The release date was March 1st, 2024. Film had a budget of $190 million. Normally, I don't do box office for new movies because it's changing all the time. but my most recent check was $665.5 million worldwide, and that's so far. Dune Part 2 continues the epic saga of Paul Atreides as he aligns with the Fremen on the desert planet of Arrakis. Facing the aftermath of his family's betrayal and destruction, Paul leads a rebellion against the oppressive Harkonnen Empire. As he embraces his prophesied role and grapples with the vision of the future, Paul must navigate a path filled with danger, romance, and the weight of destiny. This sequel promises to expand on the themes of power, fanaticism, and the hero's journey, all set against the backdrop of Arrakis's vast and unforgiving landscape. Now, personally, I thought Denis Villeneuve's Dune from 2021 stands out as, and this may sound like hyperbole, but I believe it, as a monumental achievement in science fiction filmmaking, okay? And I think he translated Frank Herbert's sprawling epic into a film that could be fit for the big screen with stunning visual flair and narrative depth. But its breathtaking desert landscapes, from those to its meticulously crafted set designs, every frame of the film is a testament to Villeneuve's visionary direction and commitment to honoring the source material. It is so good, in fact, the first film, that it was number 9 on my best films of 2021. And this is a film that doesn't even really have an ending because it's continuing. And I was so moved by the cinematic experience that it still made my list regardless. Now, I'm a big fan of hard sci-fi, and Dune hit on all fronts. Now, when we talk about part two as it moves forward, let's talk about Timothée Chalamet, for example. I think he delivers a more than decent performance as Paul Atreides. I think he navigates the complexities of power and destiny and identity well. And I think that there is depth there and a nuance that Timothée Chalamet brings to Paul Atreides. And, you know, the supporting cast, I think he's really supported by a stellar ensemble, including Rebecca Ferguson, who plays the mother, Oscar Isaac, who plays the father, and Zendaya, who plays the love interest and the, you know, a Fremen young lady. And Chalamet leads viewers on a mesmerizing journey through the sands of Arrakis, where political intrigue and ancient prophecies collide in a tale of epic proportions. Now, beyond its visual splendor, Dune captivates us with its, you know, richly layered storytelling and thought-provoking themes. Villeneuve deftly explores concepts of imperialism, environmentalism, and the nature of power, grounding the fanatical narrative and the fantastical even narrative in a thoughtfully constructed world that feels both familiar and alien at the same time. So it is really grounded in a way that I think it's easy for us to immerse into, while also leaving room for things that don't really make sense to us, like giant sandworms or like silent jetpacks, basically, and sand assassins and all this stuff that maybe is otherworldly to us or different. It's grounded in a way that we can kind of immerse into. And with this blend of the, you know, the action sequences, philosophical ponderings, the emotional resonance that I think the film does actually execute, though on the emotional level, I think it could be stronger, but I think it's still very, very well done. Dune transcends the boundaries of genre, I think. And it offers a cinematic experience that is as intellectually stimulating as it is visually stunning. And as the first installment promised to be an unforgettable cinematic saga, Villeneuve's Dune Part 2 sets a new standard for sci-fi epics, I believe. And it really left me eagerly anticipating the third and final chapter of this, which was just recently greenlit as in production, basically. They are not production, rather, in development, so to speak. The third one is supposed to work through the second book, And I think it's called Dune Messiah, if I'm not mistaken. I don't have that in my notes, but that is a that rings true in my brain. But either way, he is bringing other aspects so that he can kind of fulfill this story. And I will admit, Dune Part 2, which I'm not going to spoil, but it does kind of end in a way that even my wife leaned over and was like, that's it? That's how it's going to end? Is there a third one? And I'm like, I don't know, because at the time when we saw it, it wasn't confirmed. There was talks of Villeneuve wanting to do one, but it hadn't been confirmed. Luckily, it is, and hopefully he can wrap this story up neatly. Now, Dune Part 2 delivers a three-hour journey that left me, as I said before, mesmerized with its relentless quality and grandeur. Villeneuve orchestrated, with the second one here, a sustained experience. You know, I felt like I was experiencing something. It's seamlessly blending excellent writing, directing, music, cinematography, and editing. And it really just brings it all together to create just something. In my notes, I have like a really kind of pretentious wording where it's like cinematic brilliance. But honestly, I just want to say I think it's something special is actually how I would put it. Every scene in Dune Part 2 is a visual extravaganza, right? From intimate dialogues shot with, you know, kind of simplicity and subtlety, and you're able to really pick up all those nuances and any depth that is there, to the epic action sequences that are just kind of pulsing with an energy. And that is partly thanks to Hans Zimmer's score, where yet again he adds another layer of depth to this Dune world. And it really, I think, can envelop viewers if you're able to give yourself over to the film. I think it envelops you in just these really powerful and unusual melodies that he's able to pull out that really drew my attention, especially as a musician. And I think it just really enhances every moment on screen. Zimmer has some scores that people like to make fun of due to kind of how similar they are. For example, if you listen to his score in The Thin Red Line and you listen to his score for The Dark Knight, for example, you can find almost identical, they're different instruments, but almost identical progressions. And there's like a Hans Zimmer sound where if you hear something, either someone is emulating Hans Zimmer or Zimmer himself is kind of like derivative of his own work, if you will, in many ways. And that is not the case here. Okay. I think this one in particular is maybe possibly among his best, at the very least, as a score that kind of stands out as an atmospheric or immersive piece of work. I think Zimmer's music here not only adds an energy and not only adds an atmosphere, but it is, I think, kind of unique to his filmography or his catalog of scores. And it's like a wall of sound at times. There's a point where Paul Atreides is essentially fulfilling prediction. We'll say it that way. Okay. And it's this really extravagant big moment, right? And there's just this wall of ambient sound, basically, that I just could feel. I mean, I didn't have to look at what was happening. I could like just feel it and feel emotions coming with that music. I think with Hans Zimmer and, Villeneuve's meticulous attention to detail, I think that all really ensures that every frame is meticulously crafted, both visually and in sound score-wise, creating really an immersive world that captivates you from start to finish. While the film's pacing is moderate, which I think is perfect, it's not super blaze fast, but it's also not like unbearably slow. Like, I think it's just a really good moderate pace. The film spans a vast narrative landscape across different planets and timelines, and Villeneuve navigates it with precision yet again, offering just enough exposition to ensure clarity without overwhelming the audience with a bunch of, psychobabble nonsense. The first film felt like so much narrative setup, but it really allowed Part 2 to be a playground of sorts. Part 2 gets the opportunity to use what was established in that first film and shine. Okay, it shines because of it. And so the world building is masterfully balanced. I think it's it provides ample depth through the environmental storytelling and, you know, also allowing viewers to fully immerse themselves into the rich universe of Dune. Now, the ensemble cast delivers exceptional performances in some cases. I think Austin Butler's portrayal of the villain stands out as a particularly devilish and unhinged character. Timothée Chalamet, as I mentioned, shines in the lead role yet again. I don't think he's like unbelievable, but he holds his own here. And I think he is able to grapple in this one with the weighty themes of destiny and war and all those things with nuance and depth. And the chemistry between Chalamet and Zendaya adds an emotional anchor to the narrative also. So it's not just a bunch of hard sci-fi stuff. There is some pretty like the love story or the familial bonds that we see kind of shown in the film that really adds something that we can grab onto. And it grounds this epic story to be more of a relatable and human story. And Paul's mother, played by Ferguson, Rebecca Ferguson, adds layers of complexity to the story in this one as well. Javier Bardem is the star to me, though. He injects subtle humor and a certain gravitas into the film with his charismatic performance and carries a weight and depth that I absolutely adore. Now, we also see his flaws in the film where his personal views begin to cloud his judgment, whether it be for the right or wrong reasons. Every character, no matter how minor, feels integral to the narrative. And I think Javier Bardem is among the best. His level of fluency with this made up like language on Arrakis, you know, there's something about it that is so fluid and so easy for Bardem that his character just really shines to me. But like I said, every character, no matter how minor, they feel integral to the narrative. And I think that's a testament to the strength of Frank Herbert's source material. But also, I have to give Villeneuve some credit for his skillful adaptation. Now, starting to wrap up here, the action sequences in Dune Part 2 are nothing short of excellent. I think they're rivaling the grandeur of epic battles that we've seen in franchises. Name one. Right? Lord of the Rings, like whatever. It might not be quite as epic, but I think they're as impactful. I really love the way that the action sequences are used here. Each moment is also meticulously choreographed and executed, but not to the extent that it draws your attention to like, oh man, they practiced that a million times. But more, it makes them look like skilled individuals on a battlefield. And I think that helps immerse viewers into this sci-fi fantasy war story, you know, and I think it's really gripping. Behind the scenes, the talent involved is unparalleled. You know, Hans Zimmer's score, as I've already talked about, Greg Fraser's cinematography really elevates the film to new heights. I think he is absolutely excellent here. Villeneuve's visionary direction really cements his status as one of the great filmmakers right now of the last decade, basically, with Dune Part 2 standing as a testament to his singular talent and passion for storytelling. Now, something I want to say about Villeneuve real quick, and you'll hear me talk about this guy with other movies that we discuss, but I think Villeneuve is the Christopher Nolan of the 2020s, okay? And let me explain that, because their film styles, their directing styles are very different. So in the 2000s, Nolan makes Batman Begins, and you know, this does really well, kicks off a new Batman trilogy or series, franchise. So then he does The Dark Knight. This is the biggest shit you've ever seen, okay? Like, when this came out, no one would shut up about it. It was the greatest Batman movie ever, blah, blah, blah. So he makes that. Then he makes Inception. Then he makes The Dark Knight Rises. Then he makes Interstellar. Then he makes, I think it was Dunkirk after that. Like he keeps just making these kind of blockbuster-level bangers, okay? And I have varying feelings about all of those movies, but I like them all. And the thing is, he was doing something in a studio system, and he was doing something in, you know, a blockbuster kind of pop level, while also still adding a certain depth and doing it really fucking well. And I see Denis Villeneuve ever since Arrival and kind of moving on, he's been able to create these big expansive worlds and these kind of higher concepts. And he is not afraid to do certain things that may or may not challenge certain audience members watching the film. And he's still doing things successfully. And he's doing it in a way that he's being recognized for it. And it reminds me of what Nolan was doing in the late 2000s, basically. And here in the late 2010s into the 2020s, Villeneuve really feels like the next, you know, person that is really going to elevate modern blockbusters and like kind of popcorn flicks to where they're not just mindless. They actually have a lot of depth and a lot of heart, and there's an immersive quality to them. And there's something more for you to chew on than just cool action sequences. I think Villeneuve is just like the guy. All right. So to kind of wrap up here, Dune Part 2, I think, is a complete triumph of filmmaking here. I think it offers an overwhelmingly cinematic experience. And I think it, in some way, I'm still thinking of it today. I've been listening to the audiobook as I drive different places and stuff of the original Frank Herbert Dune. I'm kind of obsessed with Dune right now because of these movies, because they take me to a place I don't get to go very often. And whether you see it in IMAX, which I did not, or whether you see it on a television, which I was lucky enough to see it on like a theater screen. But wherever you see it, I believe that it will hold up for decades to come. And I think it really demands to be seen no matter how you have to see it. And I think it should be appreciated for its sheer scale and ambition. So all that said, whether you agree or disagree, let me know. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Dune Part 2. Hit us up, MediumCoolPod on Instagram, or you can email us at MediumCoolPod@gmail.com. I would love to hear your thoughts. But now, let's go see what's up with Joe and Sam as we talk about The Abyss. All right, everyone. I have Joe and Sam with me. We're about to talk about The Abyss from 1989. This is written and directed by James Cameron. There are a lot of people, but Ed Harris, Mary Elizabeth, God damn it, I always... God damn it, say it!
Master Antonio.
Thank you, Mary Master Elizabeth. Antonio.
Master Antonio.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mary. Simple. I know. I fucked up the last one too. Michael Bean. Bean.
Bean. Yeah.
Why do I give a fuck about words?
I mean,
seriously, Michael Bean.
Bean.
I didn't say Bean. I said Bane.
And his name in this movie is Lieutenant Coffee.
I'm already so fucking mad.
I know. No, anyway, seriously, release date August 9th, 1989, with a budget of 43 to 47 mil. Box office was $90 million, so it definitely doubled its money there. It's currently streaming. I watched it on Hulu. I think it's on Paramount Plus as well. And The Abyss follows a team of deep sea oil drillers who are recruited by the U.S. Navy. I'm already fucking up again. To assist in a top secret mission to recover a lost nuclear submarine. As they journey to the bottom of the ocean, they encounter mysterious and unexplained phenomena that defy scientific explanation. Tensions rise among the crew as they struggle to complete their mission while facing perilous challenges and confronting their own fears and weaknesses. Amidst the deep sea exploration, they discover a breathtaking and otherworldly underwater civilization that holds the key to their survival and the fate of humanity. As the mission becomes increasingly perilous, the crew must band together to confront the unknown and overcome the dangers lurking in the abyss. Now, it is no surprise probably already that our friend Sam is a big fan. It is also not much of a surprise that our friend Joe literally picked to talk about this movie so he could give Sam shit. So this is going to be a lot of fun. So Joe, for better or for worse, tell us what watching this again was like.
Yeah, it's an interesting experience to say the least, because this is really a complex movie. It's groundbreaking in a lot of ways. Let me just start by saying that, Cameron,
we can take what we get, Sam.
Cameron took the crew underwater. Like literally they were underwater for a great deal of time. He was basically like to hell with all of the difficulties with filming really underwater. And he did these things that, to the point that the cast and crew, felt like he was endangering their lives and at different times. So, I mean, who knows how much of that is Hollywood legend and how much of that's real, but you know, he went all out to make this movie as realistic as he could. And I want to give him credit for that for sure. I have a few things that we'll bring up later that, you know, that were a little less than for him. But the biggest thing that I noticed watching this far out was that line from The Abyss to Avatar, and especially with that giant sojourn to the Titanic and back for James Cameron, that the technology that he developed for this movie absolutely informed him for making Titanic. What was it, 8, 9, 10 years later? I don't know that he would have made Titanic, or if it would have been as good a movie as it was, if not for, or certainly as an acclaimed and famous movie, if not for this movie. So this is almost his dry run. That's where I'm going to start. That's where I'll kind of start with this. Before we really start, I do want to just point out something that I thought was hilarious that I just happened to notice. And if you look in the cast list on IMDb for this, Dick Warlock was in this movie. And he played Michael Myers in Halloween 2. Oh, nice. And his IMDb picture is literally a picture of him in the Michael Myers mask filming a scene from that. I noticed that and I almost laughed out loud. If you look there, that's hilarious. Go check that out on IMDb if you want a fun laugh there. But anyway, yes. Yes, The Abyss, Ed Harris, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, a very young Chris.
Okay,
Elliott.
You can say her name better than me. Okay? Jesus. All right, now what I find really funny for listeners who are only hearing this
also
is
Michael Biehn playing a Navy SEAL before his very, I believe his very next movie was Navy SEALs when he played a Navy SEAL.
Yeah, it's a spinoff. my favorite part about this, listeners, is that Joe's talking and Sam has shaken his head so many times that I'm surprised he hasn't, you know, shaken it silly. Sam, thoughts?
Oh,
you
I
have some,
say,
I can tell.
Well, what I was shaking my head at was when Joe described The Abyss as a dry run for Titanic. Oh, fuck you.
What are your thoughts, though? I mean, why do you love this movie?
Oh, gosh.
You don't have to tell me all of, I mean, we can start with a thing, but I'm just saying, like, I mean, like, what is it, when you think about this movie, what is it that makes you go, fuck, this is good? I have a thought in my head, but
Sam likes water and aliens.
Honestly, I think there's something really oddly comforting about this movie. It's very tense. It's obviously a suspense thriller and a sci-fi adventure, but there's a warmth to it that makes me come back to it again and again. I think the camaraderie between the oil rig crew members just feels really genuine. They actually feel like lifelong co-workers and friends. The kind of world of the oil rig, if you will, feels lived in and real. There's a relationship between Ed Harris and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. I'm not trying to show you up with the pronunciation.
You are. I see it. Mastrantonio, I fucking get it now, okay?
You know, you see this relationship repaired over the course of this 2-hour-plus movie, and it really, you feel the weight of the relationship. You feel like the repair of it is earned. There's just such a warmth and heart to it. that I think I find very comforting. And, you know, even just aesthetically, I think it's comforting. There's this, you know, bioluminescent beauty to the alien creatures underwater. I think I also just associate it with childhood memories. You know, I remember being kind of entranced and scared by this movie at the same time. I've always been kind of fearful of the underwater world.
Fuck yeah, bro.
I mean, you know, the being in any sort of abyss underwater is like my worst nightmare. So I found myself simultaneously kind of like scared and attracted to it, which I think is a common feeling about movies when you're a kid. There's this kind of morbid curiosity to explore cinematic worlds that kind of scare you a little bit. You know, I remember renting this from Blockbuster when I was a kid. I remember buying a collector's edition from Best Buy and kind of poring over the special features, learning about the troubled production. There's this great documentary called Under Pressure, The Making of the Abyss, and it details, you know, like some of the extreme lengths that Cameron went to make the movie and the cast and crew's sort of backlash against those extremes. And, you know, like that's kind of a movie in and of itself. There's so much drama there and just the story of the production. So I don't know. I just have a lot of memories associated with this movie, and it's just kind of it's like a happy place for me. It's kind of a go-to comfort movie. I'm sorry. That was a very long-winded answer.
No, it was great. It was great. yeah, I saw this when I was younger, but all I remembered is, I'll just say Ed Harris in the liquid oxygen going into the abyss. Like, that is literally all I remembered from being a kid watching this movie. And so I just realized 2 days ago that it has been 2 years since I saw the movie. So yesterday I rewatched it because it felt like it was only like last fall or something. And I looked back through my letterbox and realized it was much longer ago or whatever. But I remembered it very well. And we had a friend staying with us, my buddy Dylan, and we were watching movies all the time. And this is one we watched. And I was just like, oh, this would be cool. I'm not really a huge James Cameron fan, but at least it'd probably be like kind of groundbreaking or in some way, because, you know, technologically he always does something to elevate movies, you know, probably every movie he made. You know? There's something that he's advancing, at least the production quality of. And so I was like, yeah, this would be cool. And dude, this movie blew my fucking mind, actually, in comparison. I mean, I am smack dab in the middle of you two in terms of Letterboxd ratings, where I am just really in that 4 to 4.5 cusp. Yesterday really made me want to do a 4.5. So I really like this movie a lot. We're going to talk about like certain aspects of it. I know Joe will have some fun with some, which what's funny is, Joe, some of the things that you're gonna say, I don't even disagree with you, but yeah. I do have something to fucking yell at you about, okay? However, this movie is, I mean, dude, I was trying to think, you know, there's Terminator, right? The first one, I fucking love that movie. Yep. I don't love it this much. Like, it's great, it's cool, but I'm speaking for myself, but like, it's cool. Like, it doesn't, to me, this does so much more. Aliens, this movie looks like they took the set of Aliens and made it into an oil rig. Let's just recycle all the fucking shit and make it look like an underwater thing, right? Because in my notes, I actually put like, this is basically a space movie, just underwater, you know, because it feels very much like that to me. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just like, man, this has like the things I love about Aliens as well, but it doesn't do the things I don't like about Aliens. Fuck, man, I guess I like this one maybe more. And then
hell
I haven't
yeah dude
Dude, Sam has the biggest smile on his face. But I haven't seen T2 in way too long. So that's one that I just recently put on the list of reviews for me to do. Because I haven't seen that in a long, neither have I seen True Lies in a long time. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you right now, I like The Abyss more than True Lies, even though I enjoy True Lies. But then Titanic, I've watched actually very recently. And for as technologically advanced as that movie was for its time, fucking pales in comparison to this movie, in my opinion. And then Avatar and all that shit. I mean, all the shit after, it's just like, don't even, you can't even hold a candle. You don't even have fucking arms. Okay. So like, I realized, like, is The Abyss my favorite fucking James Cameron movie? Like, I need to rewatch T2 to see, but I can't think of a movie that holds up visually better than anything. I'm not going to count like the second Avatar, though I think this movie looks cooler than that movie, but that one's so new, I'm going to get rid of that. But like Terminator, you have shitty stop motion at the end. Now listen, I like that. I have like a nostalgia for that, right? Yeah. But that movie doesn't necessarily look like unbelievable. It's just cool. Like, I love the first Terminator movie, especially the hard sci-fi shit at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then you have like Aliens. I love the Alien franchise, namely the first two, though Sam and I have talked about the third one as well. I adopt that one as well. But but yeah, like Aliens, I like that movie. But for many of the reasons, I feel like Joe is going to say he's given shit to The Abyss, I'm going to throw tenfold to these other movies. Mm-hmm. Aliens is really awesome, but I don't think it looks as cool as this. Mm-hmm. Like the underwater shit. Whenever the fucking oil rig is being like moved underwater, and the way that shit is like falling and moving, the way lights work, whenever this alien comes around and it just like fucking, what is it called? Electromagnetic force or whatever, or what, a field or whatever the fuck, but it makes all of like the electronics stop working. Yeah. And then it's like the way lighting is playing in water, like the way the close, I'm assuming Steadicam shots of people running through these really narrow aliens like corridors in this rig. I mean, dude, this movie looks fucking phenomenal, and it doesn't age. Like, there is a moment where someone is controlling a machine and it is like stop motion, but it looks better in Terminator, you know, like, and T2, let's face it, even though T-1000 is nostalgic, he doesn't hold up as well as this movie. Even though it was completely mind-blowing at the time. So my long-winded thing is, like, The Abyss is fucking amazing to me. And I'm like, I don't even like James Cameron that much. Like, but, like, this movie is, like, a different level, and it bothers me because I think this made the least amount of box office compared to the others. Sam, you're itching to say something, then I'm going to pass it to Joe in a second.
Okay.
But,
oh, I'm just loving your hot takes. Like, now we're fucking talking.
Yeah, dude, I will. I'm not a huge fan of James Cameron, so I will butcher his movie. So if we really want to get on hot takes, let's go. But like, but yeah, no, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, no, I love, you know, your enthusiasm for this. I also just want to point out, Joe looks like exhausted right now.
Well, I'm going to tie this into Joe real quick, though, because one thing you've criticized is some of the dialogue in this movie, right? And I'm not even going to say you're wrong, but you want to talk a little bit about that just to start? Because think most of the James Cameron scripts, quite frankly, are not great. And I will argue that till the day I die. However,
which is today.
Tell me. Yeah, today. But tell me your thoughts, Joe.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, I do want to throw some context out for this movie. So in 1989, you know, The Abyss came out, what I believe it was in July.
August.
It was August. Okay. It was, so, however, in January of that year, there was a movie out called Deep Star 6, which took place on an underwater working man's submarine thing, and a monster attacks them, an alien monster attacks them. In March, a movie called that movie starred Greg Evigan from My Two Dads, among other people. I saw that movie and I was a fan of it as a kid. I'm sure it's a terrible movie. In March of that year, a movie called Leviathan came out, starring Peter Weller and Amanda Pays, who would go on to be in the Flash TV show. I was a fan of her at the time. Takes place on some sort of an underwater deal where a monster attacks them. So by the time we got to The Abyss in August of 89, there had already been those two movies underwater. You know, we also had stuff like Batman that summer and Ghostbusters 2 and Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And
which this movie is better than all of
Lethal Weapon 2.
Thank you. Yes.
Listen, if Sam said I'm exhausted, it's because I got to pull my boots up because the bullshit's getting so deep in here. I'm doing that over and over. Talking about Terminator 2. And listen, it came out. Listen, this The Abyss came out 5 years after The Terminator. Yeah, I mean, The Terminator does have some shitty stuff, but The Terminator is nearly a perfect movie. And I will argue Terminator 2 is a perfect movie. Again, I'm not a huge Cameron fan these days, like not in the modern context, but, you know, I will say those are two all-time greats. I would say watch Terminator 2 again. I would argue the effects do hold up, most of them, the majority of them.
I think most of them do. It's just T-1000 is never going to look as good as he did in 1990.
No, I mean, it's one of those things that's been done so much now, like those kinds of effects. Like it's, but
and let me clarify one thing. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but let me clarify one thing with special effects. I always try to adopt a special effect from its time. Okay.
Yeah.
But CG looks fucking horrible. When it's especially when it's old, and it looks great in the moment, and then it looks like shit 10 years later. Okay.
Yeah.
That's how it always usually is. Mm-hmm. Very rarely do people use it in a way where it actually holds up. And so like The Abyss doesn't use that shit really. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like he had enough money and enough presence to like create this shit and like do it in a way that is almost timeless. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, listen, the very end of the movie, like, yeah, that looks aged. There are other moments that looked aged. I just think they look fucking cool. But Joe, I interrupted you. Please continue.
Yeah, no. I mean, and I would agree with you on those. I mean, again, that line goes from The Abyss. I mean, it does extend to Terminator 2 with that flowy, liquidy effect that, you know, that they have in this movie with, you know, where it's like the, you know, the alien is like moving through the water or is the water. And, you know, like that, and that looks, to me, that looks cool. And it looks, you know, it just looks cool completely. The underwater, you know what I thought about, and this is not a criticism of The Abyss at all. When I saw like the underwater civilization thing, I thought about Aquaman, and you know, I assume that they aped much of that look from, I mean, or even Star Wars Episode One, where they have the underwater sequence, like they look familiar to what is going on in The Abyss, and I would say the effects there are not, you know, they don't blow away the effects in The Abyss, even for, you know, from 89. So I don't think most of the effects are bad in this at all. I mean, again, pretty groundbreaking, to be honest. Where I go a little wrong is some of that dialogue. And Sam,
you
and
go
I,
wrong, all right.
Oh yeah, well, we'll talk about that. I mentioned this earlier. There's a scene early in this movie where, and I'm tired of saying her name, so I'm just gonna look up what her name is in the movie because I can't even remember.
Yeah, I'll let
Lindsay.
You wait.
I'm not trying to be a smart Lindsay ass. Is just her name. Out.
Yeah. So Lindsay is on this video call with Bud, played by Ed Harris.
They call her Lindsay, but it's fine. It's fine.
She calls him a wiener. She calls him a wiener. She's like, in here, I actually wrote it down. Virgil, you wiener, you never could stand up in a fight. And I'm like, my God, like that was in 1989. Like I would have laughed at that in 1989 and not in a, what a clever insult. Like, I was just like, what a terrible piece of dialogue.
Sam, do you laugh at
funny?
That? Yeah, I was about
right,
to say.
Right, but it's not. It's not funny. It's just stupid.
Well, like, she's working at the moment, so she can't like use real profanity.
Listen, I think they did use profanity in that scene. I don't remember now, but I bet they did.
You don't even know what you're talking about.
I don't have the movie memorized.
Give me another example, Joe, because I want to tear this apart too. Go.
So there's just a bunch of things in there. There's a part where you know, like Lindsay lists off a bunch of things to these guys. And basically, the other thing I want to say, again, not a criticism of The Abyss. This movie is Armageddon underwater. Like, this is just practically Armageddon underwater. Like, they're going they're seeking out, you know, basically saving something. They're oil rig guys, working men who are charged with doing something, working with the military. And, you know, like, I could see Michael Bay, like, watching this movie and go, oh, this movie would be so much more cool if it was in space and we were on a asteroid with a nuke, you know. And it's like, I mean, there is a nuclear weapon at play in here. Yeah. So
all I'm hearing is that The Abyss is an incredible film that inspired other films after.
I mean, it did. Yeah. Again, this is not a criticism of The Abyss. I mean, you know, he made Armageddon, you know, long before Michael Bay did, you know. But I mean, it's, you know, obviously there are some major differences, but, you know, the comparisons are there and I think are valid. I just feel like, and I'm sure it's the limitations of the way that Cameron went after this movie. You know, I mentioned how much I love The Terminator, how much I love Terminator 2. I think True Lies is a great movie also.
Really fun.
And even, you know, stuff like Titanic none of these things have the dialogue problems that I feel like this movie has. And I would imagine it is because of the problems he had shooting it, that it was hard to, there are certain things that are hard to go back to when, you know, when you're in an impossibly difficult situation underwater with air tanks and, you know, all this other shit he's dealing with, that, you know, there's like something that is not quite right. You can't go back and fix it and be a perfectionist because, you know, Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio allegedly refused to go back and participate in reshoots and, you know, other things because she was so put off by her experience in the movie. So, and a lot of people disavowed it or badmouthed it or, you know, badmouthed Cameron in, you know, certain ways over the years. So I want to say I kind of understand that, but, you know, going back to the comparison with the Terminator, the less than perfect things I see in the Terminator, I certainly overlooked. You know, like you said, some of those effects were pretty bad. That stop motion Terminator at the end was pretty bad. The effects of the, like, the sci-fi fights were, you know, pretty poor, honestly, even for the time. That was still post Star Wars. And it still kind of looked bad, but I overlook it because it fits the aesthetic of the film, you know. And here there were just some things that were just like odd cuts that I was just like, oh, that's weird. And little bits here and there from a set perspective that I was just like, oh, that looks a little bit chintzy and cheap, but it stood out a little more
cheap
to me because
the
of
set.
They're like set design. Listen, and again, you mentioned Aliens too. Aliens has some of that too. If you look at some of the sets, there, you know.
Let me challenge this. Oh, sorry, I'm going to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Oh no, that's okay. No, I'll finish the sentence. Just that, you know, Aliens has that too, where you just look at some of the sets and it's like, well, if you really scrutinize it, even on screen, you're like, well, I can see this looks a little bit cheap and this looks a little less than, you know, realistic, from, you know, as a space facility. And there are just some of those things here and there in this movie that I kind of saw, you know, that stood out. Again, they're minor amidst the, you know, grand special effects, you know, things that he championed and he created for this movie that are spectacular. I just think he focused so much on those things that he probably lost sight of the others along the way, some of those smaller things.
Now, before I let Sam loose, I have something to say about your dialogue criticism.
Okay.
Because I agree that I don't think the dialogue is always great. I think sometimes they have some really good quotes, but I don't like, I'm not even going to argue against that. Like, whatever. Here's my beef. In Aliens, I'm just going to use this as an example. And maybe I'm about to make a separation triangle where we all three just hate each other, and that's fine too. But like, when you have fucking Bill Paxton in any movie and you're not complaining about the fucking dialogue, dude, Aliens, every time the whole crew is on screen, sucks. And you have a problem with the word wiener?
yes, because Bill Paxton was supposed to be an idiot in that movie. He was supposed to be dumb.
But it's go away heat, dude. It's go away heat. It's like, it's not even like cool. It's like, You have like what the fuck's her name? I'm trying to look her up right now. Who's like the real the badass with like the fucking big gun?
Vasquez was her name.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I still can't find her, but it's there.
Jeanette Goldstein, I think, is her real name. If I remember.
Yes, you're right. You're right. She looks so fucking different in this picture. I would have never found her. Uh-huh. But anyways, it's like they're all fucking stereotypes. Yeah. And something that I love about The Abyss is like what Sam said, where you could argue there's some stereotype at play, but they feel like people for the most part. Granted, it is in a bit of a heightened state. Like I agree. Like there's nothing particularly maybe realistic, but I think it's like believable. And maybe this is just my opinion. Whereas like Terminator was like caricatures of everything, you know? And I love that movie. I mean, I'm sitting here as a fan of it. I'm just saying, like, that movie, Aliens, I have always found the crew to be just abominable. But I don't even know if that's the right word, but it feels good to say. You know what I mean? Like, it feels like the right word. But that, and again, I can't speak to T2, and I really feel uncomfortable speaking the True Lies because I just need to rewatch it, even though I like both of those movies a lot. Yeah. But like, yeah, Titanic has some terrible fucking dialogue. I'm just surprised that's your thing. And to each their own. I'm actually just giving you a hard time, but I am sincerely surprised. Sam, your thoughts on the writing and the dialogue, because I said that I'm not a huge fan of the writing and I'll fight that till the day I die. And you said today is the day I die or whatever you said. So do you have thoughts on the writing in The Abyss? I mean, where do you stand on this? Are you able to just look past it, or do you genuinely like it, or like what's the thing?
I genuinely like it. I think because Cameron's genuine dorkiness comes through. It's totally written in his voice with his personality. If you've watched him on interviews and other stuff like that, like, you know, I think it's charming. Like, is it elegant dialogue? No, but these are also oil rig workers. Like, they're, you know, they're not sophisticated socialites. So I think they're kind of like,
that's why they said wiener. Got it. No, I'm kidding.
Listen, Lindsay is a scientist or an engineer or something. Like, she invented the submersibles, right? Or the not the submersibles, the facility they're on that's underwater. I don't know. She invented something.
She at least could have said he didn't have the testicular fortitude to make the right decisions. You know what I'm saying?
She could have just called him a pussy. Kidding. I wouldn't have cared.
Well, see,
I'm just kidding. Yeah, Sam. But
I think she would consider that beneath her.
Probably. But Wiener is not.
Well, oh my God, I can't believe we're so hung up on this.
I'm not at all. Christ. I'm just stoking the fire.
I know. Now. It's okay, just, fun to keep arguing.
I'm gonna get off the Wiener line.
You're gonna because get off it's the ridiculous Wiener.
That we're that we're on Wiener so long.
That's the episode title, Wiener.
I just want to, and you know, I love Joe, but I got to give him shit for this. He was setting up the context in which The Abyss came out, and he said that after Deep Star 6, Leviathan, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, and Ghostbusters 2, after those, The Abyss was just so underwhelming.
No, that's not what I meant. No, I just meant that audiences were sick of, like, they had their fill of underwater
shit,
like scary movies slash, I mean, this is not a horror movie, but you know, they, but also like the mystery of The Abyss in the promotional materials was absolutely played up. So I feel like I feel like audiences were probably like, oh, we got another movie underwater here. Like, it was the third one of that year. And this one was the most high profile of all of them. So, you know, that's not me. Yeah. I'm, you know, I just mentioned those other movies as like summer blockbusters that came right before it. So I feel like given all of that, I think what came out of The Abyss was probably not, you know, what it was certainly not what I was expecting at the time, having remembered it and going, oh, this looks super cool. And then, you know, and then I see it and I was like, oh, well, okay, yeah, that was all right. You know, but, you know, that, I mean, that was me. I think I was, what was I, 12 when this movie came out. So, and I don't think I saw it in the theater. I think I saw it on home video, but yeah, the summer would have been over for me by August. I would have been back in school. So I wasn't going to movies during the school year as I did in the summer.
But, Sam looks so mad at you right now.
I know, I know.
Well, because that was a valid point, and I was hoping to just totally eviscerate Joe. Just like,
tell me how ridiculous I'm being.
Okay, I'll say this. I'll jump on the experience of seeing it in the theater. Mm-hmm. So this was re-released last year, the winter of last year, the 4K remastered edition, and yeah. I saw it in the theater. And it really holds up. I think it looks great. I actually think it looks better than, you know, half of the CGI fests that we see in theaters.
Can I just quickly interrupt you and make a point on that just to back you the fuck up right now? Yeah. When Lindsay is out trying to fix something and all the power goes out and she has her first experience with these beings, and it's a close-up of her face, right, in this mask, and just this bright light, this soft bright light hits her face, and she just has a look of awe. Find another Cameron movie that does that. That's all I'm saying. Sam, continue.
No, that's an excellent point. That moment's beautiful, and it looks great on the big screen. And you know, Joe was talking about kind of the crude, handmade quality of the sets, and that being maybe a bit of a weakness. But I'd say it's a strength. I mean, at least it looks fucking real. Mm-hmm. Like this is definitely better than, you know, Aquaman 2, Enchantment Under the Sea.
Back to the Future reference, you guys.
You know, you can't help but compare this movie to, you know, big visual marvels now, especially superhero movies. I mean, I just think The Abyss has this kind of like organic, handmade quality that you just don't see anymore. I mean, everything looks like it was filmed on a green screen set, and everything just kind of like blends into this computer screensaver background that seems to be the popular aesthetic of especially Marvel movies. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole though, so I'll end it there. But yeah, I mean, I think it looks great. The aliens themselves are maybe a little corny. I think, you know, there's also a strength in the sense that they look organic, they look handmade, they look like puppets. Mm-hmm. So yeah, yeah, I'll just say that I it holds up visually for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think when we I don't want to overlook the performances along with the look, because like you guys have talked about the hell of this production. There's a time whenever the water, like a certain thing happens and there's water flooding this oil rig, which, mind you, there's some really fucking long, tense moments that like keep me tense for a long duration of time, this being one of them. And Ed Harris is trying to run away from this water, basically, through these corridors. And it just looks like hell. Like, not only am I like terrified of a underwater cliff that if I were to swim over it, something will consume me coming up, you know, like that's been my since a kid, like just an irrational fear. So this movie is just like that in spades all the time. But when there's a point where Ed Harris is running through these awesome looking corridors, these aliens level corridors, And he's just getting knocked around by this water because it's flooding fast. And I the whole time I'm thinking, like, to use a wrestling reference, which, Sam, I don't know if you'll get this, but Joe, you probably will. It's like with wrestling, I love watching matches where the guys just beat the fuck out of each other. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah, it's pre figured out. Like, we know how they know how it's going to end. But they're really putting their bodies on the line to entertain us. Now, I don't want anyone to get hurt, and I know that fucks up them up for the long term, maybe. But the point is, like, I appreciate that these people are willing to sacrifice maybe years of health to be able to do this shit, right? and the matches look and feel different when that happens, rather than people who are clearly trying to take it easier, play it too safe, which those matches can be good too. But they don't feel the same.
Yes.
And when I watch this compared to a lot of like, I don't know, even something like Titanic or something, which was 10 years later, I think. No, 8 years later. Dude, like, just seeing people get thrown around by water. Seeing the dude, I'll get his name here. He played Catfish, I believe. And he is behind a door. And it's full of water. He is submerged and he's screaming through a window. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like, fuck, man, that's not only scary, but like, how did they shoot that? Like, in my head, it's like, did they just fucking throw this dude underwater? Like, yeah. And make him just scream and shit? And it's like, how is he breathing at some point? I mean, I'm sure it's easy to explain, but like, I just think of what these people went through to make this. And to go back to the wrestling thing I was talking about, where it's like they put their fucking bodies on the line to do this. You can see it with Ed Harris getting thrown around by that water. It's just the one example that goes through my mind.
Yeah.
And just how exhausting it is for me watching people swim, let alone being the ones that have to do that shit.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's great. And I think the performances are. Let me put it this way. In most James Cameron movies, I have a problem with at least one performance. Okay, I've already expressed my feelings about Aliens despite loving that movie. However, this movie, I don't really have a problem with anyone. The guy with the mouse sometimes is kind of cartoony to me, but I don't mind it, much like Sam was saying. Like, I find almost a charm to it. Yes, wieners are a ridiculous thing to say, but like Sam, I also laughed going back to wieners. Chris Elliott's in this. He plays a pretty straight role too. Like, like he's not being particularly funny. Everyone has that kind of Cameron charm to them, which does not always land for me. But in this one, it just, it's consistent. It does. And I just think the performances are great. Sam, with seeing it in the theater, especially, I mean, where did the performances hit you?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Ed Harris because, you know, he does a lot of physical stuff. And you know, he's still acting, you're still getting a sense of his character, coming through even in just, you know, physical stuff, which I think is often overlooked. You know, people don't usually look toward, you know, action adventure movies for, performance quality necessarily. I want to mention something from that documentary I talked about earlier. One of the oil rig crew guys said, you know, the basic direction was to be underwater and be scared. So in that sense, they didn't really have to pretend like they're really underwater and they're really scared. And I think that kind of naturalism comes through, you know, like you said, you mentioned Catfish like screaming through the water. He was probably really underwater.
I mean, he definitely is, but I don't know where the water ends, you know, but it, but I think it has to be deep enough because you're not seeing any bubbles. And then I'm thinking as someone who used to scuba dive, like when I was like 12, 13, 14, like not having the mouthpiece, you know, like even whenever you put it in your mouth afterwards, you have to take a moment to discharge all the water that's already been in there. Right. And I'm thinking like, if you're shooting a scene and you're screaming, you're already expelling oxygen. To then have to wait for that to go in your mouth and expel the water, their bodies have to physiologically be panicking. in my mind. Who knows in real life? But in my mind, mm-hmm. that just makes it that much more intense. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I think that definitely comes through in the movie. And I don't know. I think performances like that, where they're acting off of the natural environment and the circumstances of the actual situation and the danger of it, I think that's often overlooked. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a great example of, you know, great performances that come out of people really being scared and really being in danger. And, you know, that's pretty amazing to watch.
Yeah. 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 I will say especially the concept of that liquid that, you know, the oxygenated liquid that you can breathe it's a pretty genius stroke, you know, because just as a device for tension, because man, that's a thing for me, you know, is that, you know, that fear of drowning and the sequence with the rat and then, yep. you know, then later on with Ed Harris having to do it, it was like, you're very aware of the kind of the claustrophobia and just the panic of that situation where, you know, the rat is literally trapped inside of this liquid, you know, it's drowning until it's not, you know, and the same thing with Ed Harris. It's like that whole thing. And they give that explanation of it being, it's harder to breathe because, you know, because of the nature of, you know, having fluid in your lungs while you're breathing.
Yeah.
So your body doesn't work the same way. And that was kind of a nice little touch, I think, that really did work well and really built that tension.
Yeah. Cameron did this with like Avatar, where he tried to bring in kind of like more practical or try to make things make context or make sense in context.
Yeah.
And I just think a lot of times they fall flat for me, where I'm just like, mm-hmm. that's not as cool as you think. And I don't understand why you're going this far to like explain this. Mm-hmm. That is one that I think everyone can just relate to, the idea that in order to live, you must drown yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you can live. So it's established with the rat, which, to give anyone who hasn't seen it or hasn't seen it in a long time, one of the seals takes the dude that I was talking about earlier, who always has a rat on like his like headphones, you know, mm-hmm. this little female rat that's always on his shoulder and stuff. He carries it around the entire rig, and this guy just snatches it off of him, puts it in a basket, turns the basket upside down in this breathable liquid, mm-hmm. and the two people next to him are like, "Fuck you, guy, give me the rat back," because they think he's killing it. And you see, how the fuck did they do this with the rat?
Yeah.
That's not CG. I have no idea. The thing looks like it's fucking drowning. It's really fucking sad. Okay. Yeah. It's like gasping. It's like opening its mouth. Clearly they're doing this in multiple takes and not actually drowning the rat. Mm. But it's like, how are you doing this? Sam, you look like you have an answer, but give me a second. and yeah, it's like, that's really intense. But then like you watch the rat struggle. But then it lives. And then you watch Ed Harris do this later. Mm-hmm. What great foreshadowing for that, only to then see a human go through it. And then you can completely relate to it. Do you get what I'm saying? Yeah. I think that's great. And it's those things. Because like the fight, like there's a fight between Lieutenant Coffee and Bud, who's Ed Harris's character. There's a fight between them. Personally, I don't think it's that cool. I don't think it's bad. It's like, okay, this is going on a while. Like, I'm not hugely entertained by that sequence, okay? Mm-hmm. But, like, at least I don't, like, dislike it or hate it. You know what I'm saying? Like, so it's like, that's like where the movie might plateau for me. Things like that, right? Mm-hmm. Everything else is moments like this. It's like, what a great idea. You foreshadow it, and then you show us in context. The great scene where Bud and Lindsay are, I believe if I remember, now I'm like questioning whether I remember this specific part or not, even though I just watched it yesterday, which is really sad. But I think they're in a different, what the fuck do you call it? It's not a submarine, but like a little sub vehicle.
Submersible?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. They're in like a different submersible, and they have to swim to the rig. You know which part I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. And there's a point where Bud and Lindsay are talking about basically who is going to allow themselves to drown and then be brought back because we only have enough oxygen for one of us to get there. Which one of us is going to do that? that is fucking The Thing level paranoia to me. Like, you know, like, cause you are putting your life in the hands of the other person. Mind you, everybody, Bud and Lindsay are married. And at the very beginning, one of the first things you learn is that they're married and separated. So these people don't fully trust each other. Now, maybe by this point in the movie they do, but you know what I mean? Like, they're not on great terms. And now they have to, despite everything that's happened, good or bad, for better or for worse, one of them has to put their life in the other person's hands. That's fucking great, because it actually like pulls it off, I would argue. It doesn't like, I don't know. It's not like a Blue Balls moment where it's like, oh, this is going to be cool. And then it's like, not cool. Like, no, it fucking pays off to me. And so it's like those moments that I don't even see in other Cameron movies that stand out to me, where I just remember it really was kind of an edge of my seat movie kind of the whole time. Whereas Sam, you said that this was like kind of there's something warm and peaceful to this. Not pulling away from the fact that it gets tense, but there's something warm to you. This is comfort food for you, right? For me, like, this is a movie that I happily will sit through in tension for 2 hours plus. You know, like, most of it is scary because one of my biggest fears is just being swallowed up by an abyss of water. So, Sam, I see you, brother. But I want to pass it off to Sam, but Joe, you raised your hand at one point. You want to say something, and then Sam, take over.
So, just things I want to point out. I see two different sources here. One is Looper and the other is Film School Rejects, and they both claim that the breathable liquid is real, is a real thing, and that it was unsimulated for the rat. That they really put the rat into that and forced it to be able to breathe.
That's fucked up.
However, Ed Harris's scene was not real. That was a gag, right? And I mean, which doesn't seem like it'd be tough in the helmet, you know, to put an extra little, you know, put a little extra layer there so that, you know, to make it look like he's, you know, being basically his head's being submerged in this liquid when it's really not. That's what the claim that they're making, that this is a real thing that really exists in the world.
This is fucking crazy to me.
Yeah. And that it is, and that this, the abyss was, had problems getting released in the UK. They canceled the 4K version of it because of the rat scene, and that it was, you know, problematic from a humanitarian perspective. But, you know, I'm reading bits and pieces of it. You know, I just scanned and I'm reading little pieces of this. So that, I mean, that's certainly an interesting thing to look at too.
Absolutely. Sam, please go, because I'm going to just keep talking.
Well, I loved what you said about, you know, happily being in, you know, happily kind of existing within the tension of this movie. Yeah. And I was going to piggyback off of that scene of Lindsay drowning and being revived.
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. Go ahead.
Ed Harris is reviving her along with his crew, you know, what's so powerful about that scene is that there's a lot of layers to it. You know, he's not only fighting for her, he's kind of fighting for their marriage at the same time. He's expressing frustration at her. He, you know, talks about how, or, you know, more accurately, he screams about how stubborn she is, and, you know, she's never backed away from anything. Like, you can really feel the weight of their relationship. You can feel how many years went into it just in that one scene. I don't think Cameron really gets enough credit for the emotional heft of his movies. He's obviously known as kind of a technical wizard and a visual filmmaker, and he deserves that recognition. But I think The Abyss is a great example of really the drama and emotional heft he brings to these stories as well.
Mm-hmm. I have a question for you in return, because I was on board until you said one thing. I'm curious in like context. Like, what other movies for you have an carry an emotional weight like this? Because I agree with The Abyss. I actually want to praise that. But in my mind, I don't feel that for a single other movie that he's made. But I'm just curious what you feel, because maybe you'll convince me.
Yeah, I think Terminator 2 is surprisingly heartfelt.
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah, name the one that I don't remember well enough. Cool, keep going. That's fair. That's fair. I need to rewatch that one. Yeah.
I think Terminator 2 is surprisingly heartfelt. There's this almost father-son bond between John Connor and the Terminator that's, it kind of sneaks up on you. It's really surprising. And I always find myself kind of getting choked up at the end of Terminator 2. I think, the relationship in True Lies is very moving. I'm going to bring up another one you don't feel comfortable talking about. So maybe you just need to watch these movies again, man.
Yeah, that's what this whole fucking series is for, bruh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, that was beautiful. That was perfect. I'm trying to come up with one that like maybe will click more for you.
Do you feel it in like Avatar? Because I don't feel fucking shit.
Oh no.
And I don't even like hate that movie as much as most people, but I don't really like it. And
Actually, Avatar 2 reminds me a lot of The Abyss. And I know that'll sound like blasphemy, but there's a rescue sequence in Avatar 2. An underwater one, I think between Kate Winslet and maybe like one of her children, that kind of reminded me of The Abyss. There's a lot of focus on the sort of bioluminescent beauty of the creatures that I found moving. I admit that the Avatar movies aren't as emotional for me.
You find something in them. I get it.
Yeah. I think Titanic is obviously very harrowing. I don't know. I find all of his movies pretty emotional. I think maybe this is the most powerful one. But yeah.
I guess as someone who doesn't feel that way about most of his movies, though, I like it, especially the early ones. I would say everything through True Lies, but again, based on True Lies and T2, that's based on very old opinions, and I can't even speak on them really right now. It's been a long time since I've seen both of those movies, probably 20 years at least. So I don't have any opinion on those right now. And I don't even hate Titanic. I actually am largely positive, but it's like a 3 out of 5 movie to me. You know what I mean? Like, I don't love it, but I don't dislike it. But I don't like those movies for their emotional heft because I don't feel them. But I think that's why I love The Abyss, because I do. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think because like this one hits different, as they say. And so, like that rap moment, dude, now that you said that, that's got me. I have it pulled up on a tab to read into this later, because like that sequence is rough.
Yeah.
Like, watching that last night, I was like, I felt like tense, because I'm like, get the fucking rat out of there. Like, what are you doing? Because some of those shots, it just sits on it while it looks like it's fucking dying.
Yeah.
Like, it's really scary. You have those silly lines sometimes, and there are a couple of characters that are whatever at times. But like, even the sequence where they go into the submarine that they're searching for. That one character whom I'm forgetting his name, but the one character who is about to have a panic attack because there are dead bodies in the submarine, because the submarine like fell down and crashed on an outcropping in this abyss. So they go down to explore it. And part of it is because the SEALs need the nuke that's in this thing. And then the other team is trying to look for survivors in case there's like an oxygen pocket somewhere or, whatever. And like that sequence is fucking great. I think even just little things like all the paper and stuff in the water, just like the details in what is going on there is great, but that dude having a panic attack and then going into fucking convulsions and shit, like, dude, that's, man, it's just like the way it looks The performances, I just really dig this movie. And I'm starting to put together now between the three of us. Joe, even though you rewatched this, you seem to still have, although you have a lot of appreciation for it, which is clear. Mm-hmm. You've sure. expressed that.
Of course.
But you're still just not fully sold on it, but you like it. It's fine.
Yeah.
Sam,
yeah.
you still love this. This is comfort food. Like, you love this not only because of nostalgia, but because you find certain things in it that really connect with you that may not be in Joe or even me in some cases. And I'm watching this, and I'm like, this movie stands out from all the other Cameron movies in a way that connects with me. And I think I'm realizing that, like, why we each like this movie, or like or dislike this movie. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So since we've talked 58 minutes about it, which I love, I want to go around real quick and just ask for final thoughts. And Sam, I'll start with you. And then if Joe says some real stupid shit, I'll let you talk again. But Sam, final thoughts on kind of closing out the abyss here. Clearly you love it, but what are some final thoughts here?
I expected to go into this conversation just battling Joe to the death.
A little disappointed, but it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, the guy made valid points. He's a smart guy. No, and as he always does, Joe makes great points, and you know, I certainly understand someone not being as high on this movie as I am. So, and Joe made very valid points as to why, so I didn't have to beat him to death. Little disappointing. I wanted to have a knockdown drag out fight. No.
After we're done recording, we'll talk about what movie we could really get into. So we'll have to figure that one out. But
In closing, yeah, I was grateful to see this on the big screen recently, and it really held up for me. It's one of my all-time favorite movies. I kind of, as this discussion has showed, I have a hard time even acknowledging flaws in it, because I love it so much.
Yeah, I love that. Joe.
Yeah. Yeah. There, you know, it's funny because, you know, Sam and I talk about a lot of movies, and I certainly have movies that I just love, and I'm like, okay, maybe that's a flaw. I don't care, you know, I think that's absolutely a valid opinion to have about a movie, that you can love a movie despite its flaws, sometimes because of it. But yeah, this is just, to me, is, you know, as we've talked about those other Cameron movies kind of at length. And I think that Cameron at his best, I mean, to me, it's Terminator 2, like, and everything else is some step below it in some way. But at his best, he does things that change the movie industry. I mean, in virtually every film he's made has done something to change, you know, to change the way movies are made. I mean, not, obviously not Piranha 2, but, you know, I'm looking at things like, you know, the Terminator, Aliens. I mean, the Terminator changed the 80s, you know, in general, and created a great franchise, you know, that, you know, and then he took over for the second movie in a franchise, and a lot of people think that is a superior movie to the first one, you know, which is, again, is a distinct, you know, rarity.
Debatable. Go ahead.
You're gonna say something. What did you say? I missed what you said.
I said debatable.
Go ahead. Right. Sorry. Right. I mean, I agree. I mean, I agree with, I don't know that I agree that it's a better movie, but I love it. I probably love it about as much as the original Alien, but for way far,
it's a
far
lot
different
of fun. Yeah, it is far a lot of fun. I love reasons. That movie.
Yeah, yeah. You know, again, The Abyss did things that changed his movies and the way other people made movies. And I think I'm ready to call Terminator 2 maybe the best action movie of all time. Best science, maybe I need to amend that, science fiction-y action blockbuster movie. You know, like, I love that movie in a legitimate way. In a deep and complete way. And then, you know, in True Lies, maybe didn't change much, but it's a very solid movie. You know, and then, you know, Titanic, again, was a major achievement, whether, you know, the movie itself is I wouldn't call it a great film, but it had effects that for its time were, you know, had not really been done Amazing. Before. He certainly raised the game, and he kind of continued, even Avatar, which is, you know, from a script and a, you know, plot perspective is, I would even say is weak, but the effects were, you know, certainly again, affected the way movies were made for the next decade, especially.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot to be said for Cameron and his, you know, his shortcomings and his strong points, but his strong points are as strong as it gets. And he certainly is flexing those muscles in this movie.
Yeah. I, you know, I'm looking at the time we've been recording this specific review for 1 hour and 2 minutes, about to be 3 actually. Uh-huh. And I think for as much shit as I feel like I can talk about James Cameron, you know what? One of his movies just pushed me over 1 hour.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I had enough to say, and we had enough to say about this movie where we didn't really, other than the wiener conversation, we didn't really have much overlap with the same conversation. Like, we were moving through. There's a lot to say, and I want to give, for as much shit as I can talk about Cameron, I do want to say that, like, you're right. One thing I've always appreciated about him is every movie he puts out is groundbreaking in some way or another. That's something I can 100% concede to. Like, whether it be his special effects in Terminator for the time, even, or going to Titanic and all of the use of CG and all the work he put into the Titanic shit. How many times has he been to the Titanic? It's some stupid number of time. Like, it's like 30 or something. Like, it's dumb.
Yeah.
And so
those dummies that died in the submersible, like, were connected with him. Like, they were using a terrible version of the technology he invented to go down there.
It's crazy. But but you just called it, like, he invents technology. Like, Avatar, he invented shit so that would work. And I haven't looked into this since, but I'm pretty sure, like, in the 10 years or whatever it was or more between Avatar and Avatar 2, wasn't he just, like, building Pandora in, like, a fucking warehouse or something?
Yeah,
like, basically. Like, it's crazy. So it's, like, on that level, man, kudos to the guy. I love that he is advancing technology and pushing things forward. I think that's really important. I may not always love his storytelling or his characters or whatever, but I do love The Abyss, and I'm glad that all of us have at least something positive to say, even though Sam and I are disappointed that we didn't get to completely wreck Joe and tell him to get fucked. So
well, I didn't mention the casual sexism that I had noted. I also
just shut up.
I also didn't talk about how completely white and full of interchangeable characters the movie is, and I also didn't talk about how I didn't really buy into Bud and Lindsay's relationship and a complete way.
Ulefi says all this shit an hour and 5 minutes into this, Sam.
He just, like, buried the lead. He just mentioned the most upsetting points that he has at the very end.
Well, I've been trying to say it the whole time, and you guys are just wouldn't shut the hell up for a minute so I could say it. So
he's like, I didn't buy the central relationship.
Also, I will say the casual sexism, it was completely fitting to the film because it was, you know, it's just like this very dismissive at the beginning. I think Michael Biehn's character says it, where he's just like, oh, what are we going to call you, sir? You know, and it's just like, well, I mean, that completely fits with him, you know, because he's, he's a Marine and he's, you know, whatever, he's going to be that way. But anyway, I'll just drop there. The end. Talk to you guys later. See ya.
No, that's hilarious. No, thank you guys. Listeners, if you agree or disagree, let us know. MediumCoolPod on Instagram. You can also email us at MediumCoolPod@gmail.com. Also, go watch The Abyss if you haven't seen this or haven't seen it recently. I would actually love your opinions, but even if not, I want you to share in this experience. Mm-hmm. It is on Hulu, and like I said, I'm pretty sure Paramount Plus as well. But definitely go check it out. And it is the 4K version, I believe, that is streaming right now, which is exciting. That's what I watched. So hopefully you can check that out. Joe, Sam, as always, thanks, fellas.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. That was our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it.
This was an interesting conversation, and Joe really messed things up. He was talking such shit before we started recording. Can I just say that? I need that to just be known. That's why Sam was so worked up already. it was so much fun. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope if you haven't seen Dune Part 2, you definitely go check that out. I'm a huge fan of these Dune movies because I think that there's a real, in fear of sounding like a complete douche, like there's a real auteur behind them. And you just don't see this on this scale. And I'm really into it. In terms of other movies, though, that will be coming out, hopefully, to a theater near you, we have Civil War, which is the new film by Alex Garland, who also did things like Ex Machina and what was the other one? Annihilation, I think it was. Don't Tell Mom the Babysitter's Dead remake comes out. The horror film Sting comes out. And then the really divisive film Sasquatch Sunset has a limited release. It also expands next week. If you haven't heard about this movie, just Google Sasquatch Sunset. I'm pretty sure that Jesse Eisenberg plays a Sasquatch. There's several other actors in it. It is very divisive right now. I'm reading a lot of opposing views on this one, so that'd be interesting. So there are a few things coming out for you. Other than that, I hope you have a lovely week. We will see you next week whenever we... Let's see. I'm all screwed up now because I had a schedule, and I don't know if I'm going to do Being John Malkovich next week or if we're actually going to talk about the next thing. I'm not sure yet, but just know that there is stuff in the can and something's going to be posted, and I hope that you'll listen to it. Other than that, I really appreciate you being around. Thank you. Good night. Good luck, and take it easy.